Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 84 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, novelist William Palmer explains the importance of craft, skill, and empathy in successful fiction and examines where novice writers often go wrong. Then poet John Sadiq introduces the laboratory of his notebook's pages and explains how keeping a journal can lead to a more conscious and loving way to live. First up, here's William Palmer with Nobody Asks You to Do It.
The other day I came across an old notebook, on a page of which I'd written, or rather deeply gouged in big, jagged letters, Nobody asks you to do it. I can't remember what particular desperation caused this outburst. Any writer will know only too well the potent mixture of depression, rejection and self-pity that frequently attacks us. It's not even particularly original as a statement. I've known at least two other writers who said that a similar sign should hang over every desk. It did make me think again about the whole mystery of writing, and what is the true satisfaction for the writer. People say, oh, it must be really exciting to publish a book. It seems too hard to tell them that the experience is often a disturbing and disheartening one. So where does satisfaction for the author lie? For me, it's in doing it. The deep joy and raging frustration in attempting to make something out of words. I'm puzzled when someone tells me they'd love to be a writer, just that. Not that they want to write novel A or poem B. The question of how a particular piece of writing comes to be written and the craft involved aren't seen as relevant. These would-be writers tend to shove off pretty quickly when they realise what's entailed in producing a book. I use the word craft rather than art, because craft has fallen on rather hard times, and it's almost always nowadays seen as a poor relation to art, with a capital A. But until the 19th century, the words art and craft were virtually synonymous, although, as the Oxford English Dictionary says, they diverge in their modern senses. The OED goes on to say that the word craft now stands for skill, skillfulness, art, ability in planning or performing, dexterity, and as a secondary but also important meaning, craft is a euphemism for adeptness in the occult and magic. So, by extension and mixing the definitions, craft is human skill, art as opposed to nature, a skillful contrivance, a magical device, a spell or enchantment. I'm talking about the craft of writing because in the end a piece of writing must be able to accurately convey information in an intelligible form from one human being to another. It requires empathy with others, imagination and passion. The impulse to write must come from the insistence of the material in your head to be put on paper, to be conveyed to others. For me, the actual physical equipment for the practice of the craft is very basic. At its simplest, a pencil or pen and some paper. This advice may puzzle anyone under the age of, 40? Surely it's easier and quicker to write directly onto your laptop or PC. Well, yes, but the task of writers doesn't consist in making things easier for themselves. The easiest thing would be to not begin at all. The aim is to get it right, and putting it straight onto a screen can be dangerous. The problem is, what you've done looks immediately so good, almost like a page of real print straight away. I find that I need the actual feeling of lightness and intimacy of the pen against the paper. The other good thing about this antiquated method is that it makes you work twice as hard. In transcribing a manuscript onto the keyboard, you're driven to reread and, most importantly, to rewrite and revise. It's interesting to see what two famous writers have to say about the craft of writing. The first is Evelyn Waugh. In 1957, Waugh published a novel called The Ordeal of Gilbert Pinfold. It's the story of a middle-aged writer cracking up on a mixture of drink and sleeping potions, and is probably the most directly autobiographical of Waugh's works. Waugh underwent a similar nervous collapse, and it's pretty plain that the words in which he describes the type of writer Pinfold is could equally apply to himself. The novel begins. It may happen in the next 100 years that the English novelists of the present day will come to be valued as we now value the artists and craftsmen of the late 18th century. The originators, the exuberant men, are extinct, and in their place subsists and modestly flourishes a generation notable for elegance and variety of contrivance. It may well happen that there are lean years ahead in which posterity will look back hungrily to this period, when there was so much will and so much ability to please. Well, that's precise, elegant, but a little depressing to the romantics amongst us, perhaps. The American novelist Jack Kerouac held a rather different view. He said, in an interview, "I spent my entire youth writing slowly with revisions and endless rehashing, speculation and deleting, and got so I was writing one sentence a day and the sentence had no feeling. God damn it, feeling is what I like in art, not craftiness and the hiding of feelings." Cassidy also began his early youthful writing with attempts at slow painstaking and all that crap craft business, but got sick of it like I did, seeing it wasn't getting out his guts and heart the way it felt coming out. I can't help thinking that Kerouac and Mr. Waugh would not have hit it off. Kerouac's favoured method of writing was to insert one end of a roll of kitchen paper in his typewriter and continue to write, without commas and full stops and all that crap, until he got to the end. It's a way of doing it, and always a legitimate if they succeed. But any red-blooded young writer is going to feel angry with that bit in Waugh's lines. So much will and ability to please. That's not what art is it? Art is about shock and in your face and on the cutting edge. Yes, it is. But after that rather staid, ironic introduction, Waugh's novel goes on to describe not village tea parties and polite conversation, but hallucination, madness, alcoholism, despair, love, things with which Kerouac and a lot of other writers are concerned. And I do think that Kerouac is confusing art with life, of thinking that art directly imitates life. John Masefield once wrote a novel called ODTAA, an acronym standing for One Damn Thing After Another, which is a pretty good definition of life. But writing isn't putting down one damn thing after another. It's selecting, encoding and shaping life. The trouble with a lot of the writing I read by aspiring writers is not that it gets down life raw and bleeding on the page, but that it is actually duller than life, less vital than life. Jane Rogers described it well. She said, "The sort of self-indulgent, sprawly mess with which all teachers of creative writing are familiar, which deals at length with love and depression, thoughts of sex and death, poetic flashes from dreams, and deep psychological insights into the nastier aspects of humanity." What is generally most noticeable about such a piece is the lack of narrative structure, the dearth of plot and characterization, the absence of humour or irony, and the lack of intellectual rigour throughout. Kerouac's method was to try and include every immediate and fleeting sensation and thought. The result can be an intermittent poetry, especially when you hear Kerouac reading a short bit. But the books he wrote became progressively more windy and unreadable. The Kerouac take is that merely declaring your individuality is sufficient to portray the world, but men and women taken at their own evaluation and without relation to the rest of life around them are not that interesting. interest in life comes from the interactions of people in whatever we do to each other. A lack of interest in others is not a good start for a writer. A young man I had as a student showed me a story he'd written. It opened with a man slumped in a street. A woman helps him into her house. They talk in a rather disconnected, bizarre way, and the story ends with the man dying in the woman's arms. Well, it's quite an interesting setup, but I was puzzled by the lack of detail and real human contact. Both the characters seemed amorphous, floating, out of touch with reality. I asked him how old the man was supposed to be. He didn't know. He hadn't thought of that. He wanted, he said, for the man to be representative of all men. I pointed out the difficulties. The age of someone, their place in time, whether young, middle-aged or old, profoundly alters their relation to others. And what age was the woman? She was young. Oh, well, that alters things too, doesn't it? She may have known this man before, he hinted darkly. Well, that wasn't in his story either. The problem was that he simply wasn't interested in what he was writing about. The people in his story didn't exist as people. They were there to make some dimly perceived philosophical point. Vladimir Nabokov defined this problem of life and art when he said, "Literature was born not the day when a boy crying wolf, wolf came running out of the Neanderthal Valley with a big grey wolf at his heels. Literature was born when a boy came crying wolf, wolf, and there was no wolf behind him." The first step, then, is to have a wolf. That is to have something to write about. Something sufficiently powerful enough to make you want to write it down. You also have to learn to handle your chosen medium, which is language. To write simply and effectively on a purely technical level is about as hard as learning to play the piano. But of course, there are degrees of difficulty. To pick out some sort of tune on a piano is not so difficult. To play well enough to please others than your mum is more tricky. And where do writers go to learn their elusive and difficult craft? The first creative writing course was probably the training Flaubert prescribed for his pupil Guy de Maupassant. This consisted of Flaubert setting exercises in description. His pupil had to write about a tree, a carriage, a person, in such an exact way that each particular one could not be mistaken for another. In other words, Flaubert was saying that there is no truth in the type, only in the individual. The individual exists, the type is an invented, bloodless abstraction. And fiction begins when we start to tell stories to each other. At the simplest, this can be just a joke or an anecdote, or even a quite complex tale, often repeated by its narrator, and gaining each time in added detail, usually untrue, so that in time the narration of an actual event almost becomes a work of fiction. But writers can't rely on the indulgence of a captive audience. To put a story into the public domain, a whole new order of presentation is required. The additional quality that this writing calls for is empathy, the ability to immerse oneself totally within the identity of other, separate human beings. Well, as I said, nobody asks you to do it. And after these rather clinical words, craft and skill, let me conclude with words that sum up what is the purpose of any work of art. Words that Beethoven wrote at the top of his Missa Solemnis. May this, which comes from the heart, go to the heart.
That was William Palmer, recorded by Carol Angia. You can find out more about William on his website at www.williampalmer.info. Next, here's John Sadiq on that stalwart writing companion, The Personal Journal.
You know that old worn-out saying that we all trot out on occasion, that life is short, blah, blah, blah. Well, there's a much scarier version I'd like you to reflect on, which is that life is actually pretty long, and it's most likely that we're going to be around for a good while. So what are we going to do with our days? At the time of writing this, I'm 50 years old. As of today, I've actually been on this planet for 18,496 days. It's so easy to go through our days and not notice them, to not see much outside of ourselves. As I look around, I see many people living life in fear. I see programmed shame operating from the deep unconscious, people feeling politically manipulated, buffeted by life as they try to find a safe shore, but never really believing that any real security can be found. The culture of striving and anaesthetizing continues the cycle, making us feel more and more isolated. This day will pass, and so will the next one. If we don't reflect on the pattern and wonder of things as our days unfold, we might come to believe that we have not lived. Even the very beautiful moments pass quickly into forgetfulness. We can only see, if we allow ourselves the time to look, and more importantly, if we will pause to reflect and connect the patterns of life as they reveal themselves to us. I've found that as we write, we gain insight, empathy, and wisdom. Rather than trying to force life into shapes with our minds, constructing frameworks or a personal religion, a solution which we try to apply to all things, so that our egos can establish the illusion of separateness on our small islands. This is certainly how I spent many years of my life, and please hear me when I say I do not know better than anyone else. I just sense that there has to be a more conscious and loving way to live. I think we all do, and that's a miracle. No matter how bad the news makes things look, we all have that capacity, that sense, that there is much more to us, though we are numb and exhausted, and it can be very hard to see our way forward. Perhaps we just need to tap into our courage, allow ourselves to let go of our programming, to be present, and to be in life without trying to force interpretation onto it. I think this applies especially to ourselves and how we relate with other people. After all, we are not puzzles to be solved. We are life itself. Strangely, I've never thought of myself as a writer, but I do have the sense of being a journal keeper, a recorder of things. This daily practice is the source of all my work. Every poem or book idea has started life in the laboratory of my notebook's pages. Understanding the true motivation behind the things we're doing with our lives seems paramount. The mind and the heart can be very tricky masters. They will often try to get us to react in highly egoic ways, which don't give us the love or nourishment we really need. So I guess, if my journal has one particular function, is to try to get to the root of my genuine motivations. To understand and build a path of baby steps, which can lead me forward to a place of greater integrity and clarity. Without the space to reflect, the human race doesn't do very well. We need spaces in which we can ask questions, in which we can connect to life with passion. We need space to daydream, to unload our burdens, notice the beautiful stranger, and fall in love with small, small things. I suppose that journaling has both an inner and an outer component. The inner being a way of building a relationship with the deeper self and looking at what drives us, understanding life's unfolding movement and taking a conscious and courageous interest in working with that process. The journal is also diaristic in that we can record the events of life to both note them down and to understand the interplay with others that we're engaged in. As someone who at times has been called a confessional writer, I found that finding the universal elements in personal experience has been absolutely essential in the creation of those writings. The outer component of journaling is also very important. Perhaps, once you've established a decent communication in your relationship with yourself, it then opens you up more to other people. It certainly seems to be moving that way for your correspondent. The journal has become a place to record the world as it presents itself each day. And it gives the writer the space to juxtapose elements which can then naturally build into stories. We might record a landscape or a scene unfolding one day, then note an interaction between two people on another occasion. And because we have this space, we notice that somehow they are related. There is something in the soul of the artist which recognises how seemingly disparate elements can fit together. When we place these things next to each other, relationships are created, and all the writer then has to do is allow them to speak for themselves without getting in the way too much. I've always enjoyed transparency in the books I've loved, and it's one of the things I've worked hardest at in my own writing career. I think one of the greatest difficulties we suffer as a species at this time is that we are not seen for who we really are. Many, if not all of us, are left feeling oppressed or invisible or both. Or it seems that we're being served up falsely for the ends of big business or the power hungry. I've found trying to protest often results in no change whatsoever. But when something is simply witnessed and recorded, it speaks with an integrity that the reader knows is true by awakening, or rather, by tuning us into our natural empathy and understanding. I think this is one of the main reasons I'm such a believer in the power of literature. This is all pretty big stuff, but it's these depths that give this writer much of his joy with his work. On a simpler level, keeping a journal allows me to spend an inordinate amount of time people watching over cups of tea in cafes all around the world. It allows me to feel that I have a home and a purpose wherever I am. When I open my notebook and get my Waterman fountain pen out, I'm at home and there's work to get on with. I'm one of those people who is never without his notebook. I love observing the spaces between and around people. I try my best not to interpret, but allow myself to see the story that is plainly there. As I write this, I'm in Manchester Art Gallery's cafe. It's Saturday afternoon. At the table next to me, there are two dads with their daughters, who must both be about 7 years old. It's the dad's day for spending with their children, and they're talking as a group about the art that they've just seen. As they talk about colours and the stories in the paintings, they're eating Victoria sponge cake and drinking 7-Up. If I'd not sat down and doodled these notes, this small story would not have been recorded. And of course, it's not a small story at all if we put ourselves in the father's or the children's shoes. To spend time with the people we love is all most of us really want in life, or it's certainly one of the main things which is at our centres. Imagine how it must feel when that time is limited by court orders or by agreements with someone we don't communicate well with anymore. At the table next to the dads and daughters, a woman in a deep pink sweater is drinking from a huge cup. Her husband is sitting on his hands. He's dressed completely in navy blue. Next to them, two women wait for the waiter to bring their lunch. One gesticulates with wide movements. The other keeps her arms folded tight across her stomach. Both the women are laughing freely. To be at home in the world. To see people and to let them be who they are. To be on decent terms with one's own life, relating with love, courage and concern, not reacting from a fixed framework of the mind and ego, but taking the time to contemplate, to be a witness, a partaker, a scientist of life. I find that the daily recording and exploration of ordinary things connects me profoundly with life. Perhaps the very ordinary is the most meaningful thing we have.
That was John Siddique, recorded by Francis Burns. You can find out more about John on his website at www.johnsiddique.co.uk. That's Siddique, spelt Siddique. And that concludes episode 84. Coming up in episode 85, the non-fiction writer Helena Attlee tells George Miller about her unconventional start as a garden writer and her long-standing love affair with Italy. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.